March the 26th, 2011. This is an interview with Mr. John H. Adams. Mr. Adams just informed me that he is 92 years old. So I thank you, Mr. Adams, for taking your time to volunteer to share your story with the research library and for future researchers. When we're going to talk about today your experience during World War One, doing World War Two, and in doing that, let's just start out with how you happened to become a part of the military during World War II.
Well, I was living at 2020 North 3rd Street. I was a motion picture projectionist at the Princess Theater, which was on 5th and Franklin.
And this is in Kansas City, Kansas?
Kansas City, Kansas. I had graduated from Sumner High School.
What year? Do you remember what year graduated from Sumner High School?
Oh, yes. May of 1936.
What kind of memories do you have about Sumner?
Well, Sumner High was the only high school that blacks could attend at that time, at least in our area. It was a very, I'd say, dedicated school as far as the teachers giving their all as far as trying to help the students to progress in their particular choice of academic excellence or the jobs afterwards. We had some of the most dedicated teachers I think we had, all black. I would rate them class one, class A, as far as their dedication to the students, male and female.
What, any favorite teachers you remember you had?
Oh, yes. My favorite teacher, I guess, was an English teacher, Miss Scotty P. Davis. She was a single woman, as far as I know, very particular. She wanted the best of her students to perform in any way possible. And she was very adamant about making sure that you had prepared for your classwork when you came to class. And I think Mr. A.T. Edwards, a gym teacher, is quite dedicated as far as allowing students like myself, who finished and was, I had no idea about attending college at that time. I was permitted to come back and take his college course in architectural drafting. He permitted me to be a part of his classroom. I don't know whether that was possible with the principal or not, but he allowed me to attend classwork there, take his college work, and hopefully that I would be able to attend some college work later. I had numerous teachers, my physical science teacher, Mr. Harwell, Mr. Thompson, Max Spears, English teacher, Miss Penman, Miss Jackson. There's so many teachers there, Mr. Mowbray in was it woodwork and metalwork. All of those teachers gave their time and effort to make sure that the students who came under their jurisdiction prepared themselves not only for the regular work, but for their college afterwards, or their work afterwards. And not many of them were going to college. It was a poor area back in those days. I think that was the time of depression, 1930s. I guess that's one reason I wasn't preparing to go to college, because I had to help take care of my parents. My father was ill, and I had a chance to take over his job as a projectionist there. So I wasn't going to attend college. I had a job.
Okay. So you were living and you were a projectionist at the Princess. How did you view the war before you I assume you were drafted?
I was drafted. I did not volunteer. I was placed in as the only male in a particular family, taking care of my parents as I was. I was put in either 3F or 4F at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Later, when there was a need for more volunteers and they weren't coming forth, I was classified as 1A and I was drafted. So I went in the service in October of 1942.
Really? So did you have any sisters, brothers or sisters?
I had one living sister, Alice Laurie, who was a year ahead of me.
Mm-hmm.
She was married and not living at home at the time. I had a younger sister. She died at 3 years of age from spinal meningitis.
Okay.
There were only three of us in the family.
Okay. Okay, so what was your view of the war before you were getting involved in the military?
Well, I really didn't give the war too much consideration as far as I was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to volunteer, but working as I was, and obligated at that time to help take care of my parents. I had to register in the draft, so it wasn't necessarily a means of avoiding it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were drafted, I had no problem with going, but I wasn't anxious to volunteer.
At the time that you were drafted, you remember what race relations was like in the community at that time?
In the community?
Uh-huh.
Well, living where I was at the time, I wasn't too much to be concerned about as far as race relations. It was a segregated school that we attended. There were whites all around some of the places, and some of the students had to pass right by the white high schools and junior high schools in order to get to Sumner as a senior high and to Northeast as a junior high. So far as I was concerned, I accepted the segregation as it was. Not a problem with me.
Mm-hmm. So at that time, did you hear about or read about in the newspaper any of the race riots or civil rights protests that were going on at the time?
Oh, yes. I was aware of those things that existed, and I know that as far as we were concerned, segregation in the downtown areas, in Kansas City, Missouri, for instance, and other places that were locally, segregation was a prime problem. I remember going down to, I think it was Taylor's or one place, some of the stores downtown to get it as an extra job. And everyone in line ahead of me was given an opportunity to take an application. And when it came to me, the particular person who was handling those interviews and handling out the particular request for work, she told me, "We have nothing for you, so you can exit at the next entrance there." And he took the person in the line behind me. I think there were only one or two blacks in a particular time requesting work at that store at the time. But when they came to me, she said, "Well, we won't have anything we can offer you." So I was aware of that. We could not sit down in the restaurants, in the, dime store or dollar store. We had to stand at the counter or take our food out and participate in eating it outside of the place. All of those things existed as far as being out of your own community. But I say, as long as you were in the area where most of your own race existed, well, we didn't have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But we were aware of what was going all around us, though.
How did your family respond to your draft enlistment, your enlistment?
Well, there wasn't anything they could do about it, so when they say you have to go, I go.
Okay. Where did you go, where did you enlist, Ardra? You remember?
I went to Fort Leavenworth as an enlistment. After interviews and tests there, I went to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri. That was the first camp where we were sort of quartered in tents until we were given a destination as to what place we were going to go for our training. I went from Jefferson Barracks to, Boston, Massachusetts. I was selected to participate in a drafting class, whether it was engineer drafting or topographic drafting. I had that worked in school, and I guess that was an influence on my selection to participate in that activity. So I went to Boston, Massachusetts, and attended Franklin Institute of Technology, where I was enrolled in engineer drafting. And as a result of, there were six of us, I believe, out of a class of probably 40. And one of the whites did not seemingly perform adequately, so I was given an opportunity to move up to photographic drafting.
As a result of that, at graduation, you had an opportunity to select what you want, where you wanted to go, because they had several places: Oklahoma, California, Montana, Texas. And having an aunt in California, Los Angeles, I selected to go to Marchfield, which was in just outside of Riverside, California.
Well, tell me, let's go back through the enlistment process itself. How did you travel from your home to Leavenworth? And did you have a going away party, or do you remember anything like that? What kind of preparation did you have to be making to leave home?
Well, exit from your job was one thing if you had one. We traveled from Fort Leavenworth to Fort Leavenworth by bus, and we went from Fort Leavenworth to Jefferson Barracks by train.
What was it like having to, what did you have to do to leave your job? What did you have to report to them? Do you remember what you had to do?
Just to tell your employer that you were drafted and you would be leaving.
And what did your employer say?
Have fun and come back when you get a chance to be discharged from the service.
Okay, all right. Were there other people around there who were leaving for war too?
Oh yes, they had a great gathering of friends and family members at the, I think it was the bus station at on about 8th and State, I think, at the time. And quite a few friends and family members there from, I think, both white and black at the time. But I don't know whether it was segregated buses or not, but I think we all joined on together on that one or two buses that were leaving from 8th and State to go to Fort Leavenworth.
When did you have to take your physical exams or whatever else and get into your uniforms? Was that at Leavenworth?
That was at Leavenworth. They gave you your wearing apparel, shoes, your coat, because it was wintertime at that particular time, and they performed the, physical and the mental exercises as far as examinations at Leavenworth. Mm-hmm. They made sure that you had the shots you were going to get, you were prepared, haircuts, shaves, and all that sort of thing. You weren't permitted to have mustaches, or you had to have a certain amount of hair taken off of your head. You had to pass the physicals and then prepare to get your equipment and be prepared to ship out.
Was there anything about that process that you didn't like?
Oh yes, I didn't like shaving off my mustache for one thing, and I wasn't particularly fond of the clothes I was going to have to take, but I didn't have much of a choice about that.
When you were going through this process, was everybody there who was checking you and engaging that, were they African-American or were they white, or do you remember?
Well, I think there was a PFC, that's a private first class, who met us as we got off the bus. Mm-hmm. And he acted like he was the company commander, the way he was given instructions and all. But he was militarily, I don't find anything necessarily segregating as far as his voice was concerned, but he just had a job to do to get us processed, to get ready to go. And so mm-hmm. he was pretty strict about how he wanted things carried out.
Was he black or white?
White.
Okay, the other guys who were going through the line, getting the distribution of the clothing, were they white or black, or was it a mixture, or was everyone black?
I think it was a mixture.
Okay, so what else did you do? How long did you stay overnight at Leavenworth, or?
Overnight.
Okay.
We were ready to ship out the next day, and we went to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri.
Okay, what was that like?
Cold. They had us in tents. We had to sleep in our particular clothes, wearing coats and all, because they didn't have heating facilities in the tents. And that we were there in the evening, and the next morning, we had to go through physical exams, mental exams, checking as to whether or not we had needed any dental work, that we had the proper supply of clothing.
In those tents, were they? Was it also racially mixed in those tents?
No. I was strictly with four or five blacks, I believe. It was large tents, but sleeping quarters is all we were provided for at that time.
Uh-huh.
But we were all segregated as far as I know.
Do you know where the whites were? Was a white company nearby or anything?
I wouldn't have the slightest idea.
So everybody in that area where your tent was black or white?
Black.
Everybody was. Mm-hmm. So did you have some who were officers, black officers, or anything like that, or do you remember?
You know, those coming in?
No, those that were in your tent area.
No, we didn't have any commissioned officers. We had non-commissioned officers.
We're talking about your experience in the barracks in Jefferson. Where was it?
Jefferson Barracks, Missouri.
Jefferson Barracks, Missouri. Mm-hmm. What time of year was that?
Winter. November, December.
Wow.
Because in December when I went to Boston, and it was a great deal of snow there, but that tent in Jefferson Barracks, there was no heat there, so the four or five of us in that particular place had to have, slept in our clothes. But we'd go stay over there overnight.
Uh-huh. Did they provide you with any food or anything?
No, no. This was late in the evening when we got there. I think we ate breakfast the next morning. But as far as food that night, there was none, unless you had something that you want to knick-knack on yourself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How did you quickly get friends with the guys in your tent, or did you?
Well, if I can remember this, most of it was, trying to keep warm. And I don't think there was too much, and it was late at night, and most of those guys were probably going to get sleep.
Right.
And I remember that's what I did, because I dozed off until next morning when they came in to wake us up and say it's time to come up here and get set for your test and that sort of thing. And so it was a matter of not too much in the way of conversation at that night. And then the next morning, we just marched off in order to get our particular examinations and all. So being friendly with to a extent where we're going to be together wasn't something that we really considered, because we weren't going to be together too long. We'd be separated into whatever designation they wanted you to attend, whether it was schooling or work, quartermaster, supply, what.
Were you happy with what choice they made for you?
Oh, yes. Wasn't anything wrong with going to school. I made up my mind when they took me out of my little private life of whatever I was involved in, I was going to try to do the best I could because I wanted to be successful in and not necessarily what I'd heard about the Army with KP duty and latrine duty and all of those things for those who were trying to get out of the service rather than trying to make good of what their particular time there.
What about the trip to Boston? You said it was on a train?
On a train.
What was that? Do you remember anything about the train ride?
Oh, yes. Well, there were about, six of us, six blacks going to Boston at Franklin Institute of Technology. And we became quite friendly because we were housed in one little place. It wasn't little. It was a boarding house, I think. We were segregated. Six of us, six blacks were in one group. And I don't know whether the other, 25 or 30, 35 maybe, who was housed someplace else. But we all attended the same classroom, but we had segregated sleeping quarters. But it wasn't bad. We had six guys all came quite friendly and got a chance to associate with one another on the train, reading the manuals they gave us, soldiers' manuals, guard manuals, what to be expected of when you were in the service and how you perform, what your chances were advancement for.
Wow.
So it was quite pleasant. And the six of us had quite a nice little deal together for the months that we attended school.
Who were some of the other men? Do you remember them, many? Did they come from Kansas or did they come from Missouri? You remember?
Well, to be honest, they came from all local areas, as far as I can remember. Their homes were altogether different, but I don't know whether they were attending school. Some of them were only 18, and some of them were in their 30s. I was 20, 23 at the time, I believe.
So it was a wide range of ages
that
were together. So what was Boston like?
Well, as I say again, we lived in a segregated barracks. Most of the time we were attending class. He had an opportunity to have some type of social activities on the weekends. They would have soldiers and sailors, what do they call that, service units, where there were a group of young ladies, I think, under the guardianship of either some organization, would come out to the camp, and they would have, at their recreation centers, they would have dances and games and that sort of thing for entertainment.
Did you enjoy that?
Oh, yeah. Weekends were fine. We had a chance to, but we met only with whites. There were no black women at that time, young women at that time. It was a chance to associate with and mingle with whites who came out as a group. I don't know why that was. Maybe there were no blacks at that time who wanted to attend that. But they were quite friendly. It was quite a very good sociable event to have over the weekends.
So did you dance with white women?
Sure. That was a part of the activities, and they didn't object to it. So they were there, and the fellows that I knew of, I don't remember there were no black women that I saw. So if the whites, if they were a part of it, they had to accept the fact that the black men were dancing with the white girls. But there was no really, I'd say, other than a social relationship, mm-hmm. there wasn't anything to be concerned about mm-hmm. or be indignant about. So, but it was just something to do that the organizations had it for the weekends period.
Mm-hmm. So where did you eat if you wanted to eat outside of the institute? Where did you go to eat?
Well, you mean like going to town or something of that kind?
Yes, sir. I guess.
Well, I don't think I ever, for me in Boston, I don't think I ever went out to eat anywhere in Boston. We had preparations in the barracks where we were housed. And now, if you can, as far as going to town, you had that privilege to check in and check out. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't anxious to leave where I knew where I was and what I expected as far as the association, activities, and that sort of thing. So I stayed in and studied, and then we had a recreation center there. I liked to play the piano, so I spent most of my time playing piano.
Well, you did?
Yes.
So did you ever play for some of the events there when you had the social events? Did you ever play?
Well, during the time of intermission when they had musical groups that came out, they would permit the fellows who could play, uh-huh. whether it's piano or guitar or horn or whatnot, to come up and join in. So I took the opportunity to mingle to some extent with some of the events, but not all of them.
So music has been of strong interest to you throughout your life, is
it? Oh, yes.
So where did you take formal training in piano?
No, my parents gave my sister and me piano lessons when we were young. I guess I was about maybe 8 or 9 years of age. And at that time, they could not afford both of us, so they gave it to my sister, and I just copied the work. I think I took lessons for about maybe 6 months, maybe less than a year. But it was just something that at that time I learned. I play by sound. I don't play by note, by reading. If you put in front of me what I can play, I wouldn't be able to read it. So I know simple things that I can solve, but as far as playing as an accomplished musician, I wasn't.
But you still enjoyed it.
Oh, yes. Anytime I came around a piano,
did
I had an
opportunity. Did you play at Sumner in any of their bands or anything?
No. I didn't even take music in Sumner.
Oh, really?
No, I took drafting and gym work. What else did I have? Tennis, swimming. I didn't swim in school, but they had exercises that they would allow you to participate in.
Uh-huh.
At that time, I don't think swimming was a part of the schools. But I did a great deal of woodworking, metalworking, and that sort of thing, Mr. Mulberry's class. Activities there, as I say, I wasn't big enough to play basketball, mm-hmm. but I did a lot of tumbling. Football, without the question. I was more or less a bookworm more than anything else as far as school was concerned. I enjoyed school and reading and studying.
That's good. So what were your teachers like in that? Do you remember anything about your teachers at Franklin?
Well, they were all white. As far as I'm concerned, they were just as fair as they could be between. And as a matter of fact, they gave me an opportunity to move up from drafting engineering into topographic engineering, and they didn't have to pick that. They didn't have to allow me. I don't know whether it was grades or the alphabetical order of the last names that made it possible for me to move up from drafting engineering into topographic, because when you graduate, those who graduated from the topographic class became corporals. They had two stripes. Those in from the drafting class, as an engineer draftsman, they were PFC. They only gained the one stripe. So it was an advantage to have the opportunity to be a topographic draftsman.
Wow. So you moved up.
Yes.
So after Franklin, then did you graduate, or how did it go?
I graduated. There were out of the class, I think all of us were assigned to different places, but those who graduated in the top were able to select the places they wanted to go. And I see I had an aunt in California, so I chose California. I had a guy from St. Louis, Cletus Bardo, whose home was in St. Louis, but he wanted to go to California too. So he and I became buddies on the train, riding out to Marchfield, where we were both assigned.
So did you contact your aunt when you got there?
Not immediately, but after I got acquainted with the Marchfield rules and regulations and knew where she was, I contacted her by phone to make sure it was all right if I had an opportunity to visit her, that she would not object to it. So, but I made contact with her later on.
So did you write letters back and forth to home while you were doing all of this?
Oh, yes. Quite often, taking care of keeping in contact with my parents and the lady friends that I had left there at a particular time, been dating for some 3 years, I think it was, and I kept corresponding with several friends, male friends and female friends, so, as well as my parents.
That's great. Did you keep any of those letters?
No, not
that
really.
That they sent to you?
I think I did for a while, but I became too much extra baggage was not permitted, so
yeah, that was
disposing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, let's see, what was it like in California? What was that setting like? You want to describe it? Who were the people? What were your living quarters like? That sort of thing.
Well, it was regular barracks, all blacks. No whites were involved as far as Marchfield. It was a segregated area there, too. But it was nice. Got a chance to, in as much as I studied drill and calisthenic exercise, and I was made personnel in charge of giving drill instructions in calisthenics, and got a chance to move up to earn my next stripe, became a buck sergeant. As far as the barracks and all were concerned, there were several barracks with two levels of floors, maybe 25 on the first floor, 25 on the second floor to accommodate the particular company.
What was the name of your company? Remember?
No, the only thing I can remember was an aviation engineering squadron,
okay.
Engineering company.
Okay.
We had about 200 maybe or 300 individuals in that particular group.
And they were all African Americans?
All African Americans, yes.
Were there any officers? Did you have any black officers?
No, I'm trying to think. Did we have black? Yes. Well, I know we had non-commissioned officers that were black, but whether or not we had non-commissioned officers that were black, but non-commissioned officers. I don't remember seeing too much of those. Even in our parades, we didn't have... Now, I take that back. The company commander was probably white because we had to pass in review in front of that particular stand several times during our stay there.
Mm-hmm.
But they were white. Maybe I think they were probably integrated to that point, white officers and black officers mm-hmm. in their different positions. But the non-commissioned officers were all black.
Did they treat you okay? Did you all get along well? Or
well, I can remember one incident. Let's see, what was that? Not in Marchfield. No, one incident in Marchfield. As far as volleyball exercising, and we didn't have tennis court, basketball courts. They had mixed groups of playing in different sports,
uh-huh.
particularly volleyball. As far as Marchfield was concerned, it was still a segregated unit. And segregated until I went to Alabama.
Okay, and, well, tell me, Well, what town was this place, was this barracks located? What town in California?
In California. Marchfield is close to Riverside, California.
Did you ever go to the city there?
Yes, a couple of times.
What was it like?
Segregated. You stayed away from it. I had met a couple of ladies who invited me to their homes to meet their parents, who came out on that regular weekend service unit to meet with the fellows and to have that social events.
Uh-huh.
Got a chance to go into Riverside and meet the families of those particular young ladies. Now, see, again, they were still in a part, as far as I can remember, there was no great mixture, even of the young ladies, because I went to their homes. Didn't really have any type of racial reaction at Marchfield at all. It was strictly, we stuck to what we were doing in a group.
Uh-huh.
But it was fine.
Okay. So after California, where did you go? Do you remember?
California, I had an accident of doing the calisthenic exercises. I broke the small bone in my left leg, the tibia, and the organization was put on alert as to go overseas. Well, I guess fortunately in one way and unfortunately in another, I was left behind when the company was ordered to leave, and I stayed in the hospital with a cast on my leg for about 30 days, I believe.
Wow.
So when I was released from the hospital, I was assigned to another company. And as much as I could type, they put me in the office, and I worked as a company, I don't know what position it was,
mm-hmm.
but other than the fact that I was one of those who was handling the orders and doing the typing, working with that staff.
Right.
That's when I had an opportunity to see on the list, on the board, they were seeking blacks who were interested in trying to be a part of the cadet training for a possible future as a pilot, bombardier, or navigator with the 332nd group of in the Air Force. I took a chance on, since I didn't have the 2 years of college training that was required, then the list dropped that particular requirement and said if you can pass the test, mental and physical tests, you would get an opportunity to, if you are accepted as a cadet or a student. So on my application, I had to send for my high school records, and my dad got those things for me. Sent them in, and I was accepted to participate in the cadet corps to a possible future in flying.
So you wanted to pursue this?
Oh yes, I didn't want to stay behind with a company where there's no need for me. My company that I was trained with, mm-hmm. had gone overseas. So this was an opportunity, since the requirements were that I could meet, as long as my academic credits were all right, they accepted me, and I was accepted to go to Tuskegee, where I took a mental, physical, academic aptitude test and passed those and got a chance to be sent to Tuskegee to be a part of the flying program.
So you went to Tuskegee?
Oh, yes.
What was it like? Tell me what, you know, how did you get there? By train?
Oh, yes. Well, I stopped off at Kansas City. I had 2 or 3 days to stay there to visit my folks. And when I left there, I got on the train.
How long have you been away from home then? About a couple of years or about a year or what?
Oh, close to 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
We went there by train. And when we got to some border, I think, leaving for either Kansas or Missouri, we had to change to a train, which was a segregated train. And we had to, all blacks had to be in one area and the whites were in another, as far as the soldiers were concerned. That was my first encounter with what they call it, the Mason-Dixon line.
Right. Jim Crow on the train.
Yeah, Jim Crow. That was my first opportunity to be a part of that. And we got left a fairly decent train and got on a train where the smoke was coming in and the cinders were flying in through the windows. it was a pretty sad affair as far as a passenger train was concerned.
But you were relegated to a certain car.
Yes.
And there were other cars that were that the white soldiers went on.
I assume that I didn't come in contact with them because you see, it was a passenger train, and we had all kinds of individuals going from one place to another.
Right. So it wasn't just military.
No. Mm-hmm. It was, as I say, it was a Jim Crow deal. When you passed that borderline, wherever it was, you had to transfer from, particularly with the military. Now, I don't know about the regular people who paid their way there, but as part of the military, a soldier had to leave that particular area and get in that train. Now, I don't remember seeing any whites in that area, and I don't remember seeing necessarily black soldiers. But there were other black individuals on that particular train where I sat.
So you were traveling by yourself?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So then, how did you get to Tuskegee? From the train, what did you take?
I went by bus. I made the mistake of going through the doorway that was marked for whites only. I didn't recognize that fact until I had gone through the door and saw on the other side they had a fountain up there, drinking fountain, whites only, and colored on the other sides. And when I turned around to look up, I had had passed through the door that said for whites only, which I wasn't supposed to do. But I guess if they're just stupid soldiers, they know where he's going anyway, so they didn't pay any attention to me. But I remember that explicitly because of the fact that there were two doorways there and they had separate drinking fountains. I had read about that and heard about drinking fountains for blacks and whites only, mm-hmm. but I had never come in contact with anything like that. But I didn't have any trouble with it. I guess they overlooked me because they didn't know what I was doing anyway. But I got from off the train, and they had a bus there.
You had your uniform on?
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. I had progressed to tech sergeant. I had 3 up and 2 down on my particular enlistment. I didn't mean anything. So they put me on a bus that was there particularly for soldiers, and it took me to the, I guess it was Moton Field, where Tuskegee school was.
Right.
So I traveled in a different area there, not from the institute itself. We attended the institute as far as our academic work was concerned, but Moton Field was where we were going to get our flying training. So that was an experience for me. I'll never forget that.
Yeah, so what was, so you got to see Tuskegee University, you got to see the college itself.
Oh yes, we attended school there.
Where did you stay when you were at Tuskegee at the end?
We had a barracks that was, it was on the Tuskegee, close to the Tuskegee campus, where the other students were attending class there. But we had an area that was entirely separate from Tuskegee Institute itself, and we had to march from our barracks mm-hmm. into Tuskegee for our particular classes, then go back to our barracks, change clothes, and go down to Moton Field where we had our flying training.
So at this place, is that where you ate and did everything?
They had a separate mess hall, yes.
So you didn't mingle with the college students, the institute kids at all?
Not during school time. Afterwards, you could. They had little places where they had social events. Their campus wasn't was open as far as people attending, and you had the privilege of leaving the base and going into town or going off campus to wherever you wanted to in town itself.
Did you ever go in town?
Very seldom.
What was the town like? Do you remember it?
Well, it was segregated as far as I know, and I did not enjoy the possibility of encountering some difficulties that I had heard when I was a younger person in someplace else out of Alabama about some of the things that you would encounter, some of the way that you would be treated. Mm-hmm. So we had all kind of games and things on the base, and then until I went to Riverside, I went there several times, I would always go to spend the weekend with my aunt in California, become acquainted with her, mm-hmm. because she was by herself, she had lost her husband, mm-hmm. and I got a chance, I hadn't met her before that time, so I got an opportunity for me to visit with her.
Was that your mother's or your father's?
My father's sister.
Father's sister.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about the training at Tuskegee. What was that like? What did you do?
Flying training?
Flying training, yeah.
Well, we started off by going down to the Moton Field. You were introduced to an instructor, and those were mostly blacks that I remember. Mine was. Took me up in a Piper Cub.
What's a Piper Cub?
It's a small plane with just one wing, mono wing, on the top, not over the canopy and all itself, for the two-seater. It gives you an opportunity for the instructor to put you through the paces to see if you have the ability to withstand the flying, whether it's simple loops, figure eights, spins, and that sort of thing, to acquaint you with what you're going to come in contact with.
What did you think about that? Were you sure at that time you wanted to fly?
Well, that was my first experience in the plane, and I looked forward to it. And I didn't become ill. I enjoyed it. And we spent just a small period of time in the Piper Cub. Then we had to take several tests as far as the aptitude tests and mechanical tests, finding out whether or not you were going to be better qualified to be either training for a pilot, or training for a navigator, or training for bombardier. You put you through your paces on that.
What did you want to do?
Well, I enjoyed the flying. It wouldn't make any difference to me in what position they felt I was qualified to perform. So you have a choice, I think, and your size meant a great deal. The larger fellows would not necessarily fit into the smaller planes for the fighters. Most of them went to a twin engine, I believe, which is a larger plane. But as I say again, it was something that I really enjoyed at the time. And my first flight was successful enough with my instructor that we went from the Piper Cub to lower basic. We had lower basic, upper basic, lower advanced, upper advanced. So from primary training, we was a two-wing job, the biplane. It was the closest thing to at that particular time, to a fighter plane, open cockpit, where you have an instructor and a student in the same plane. That was what we called in primary training. We had, I don't know just how many months we spent in that, but most of the time we just kind of get an opportunity to become familiar with the requirements of plane, studying the plane, knowing how it works, attending classes to understand the principles of flying. And then you had a chance to take your first opportunity to solo after a certain amount of training with a flight instructor. After soloing in the primary, you spend a certain amount of time there with flying by yourself, doing the different phases of instruction. You went from there to BT-13, which is a much larger plane, still have lower basic. It was the fixed landing gear, the closest thing to the AT-6, which would be the advanced plane that you would fly in. Spend a certain amount of money, a month, in lower basic. And when you completed lower basic satisfactorily, you went to upper basic. From upper basic, you went to lower advanced. From lower advanced, you went to upper advanced. Then if you were still able to be a part of the group, you graduated.
So how long did all that take?
Well, let's see, about a year, about a good year, maybe 14 to 16 months. If you're able to survive primary, and you were put through your paces then and you soloed all right, well, you could make it. Providing you had no incidents that would wash you out because of lack of ability, carelessness, poor grades, or something of that kind. But I think the whole course was, from the time I went in until 43, until almost a good year and a half.
So you were talking about your flying training?
Yeah. Well, seeing the different phases from primary to basic to advanced, and if you're able to qualify and stay in and get your grades that are satisfactory and your performance is satisfactory, then you can look forward to the possibility of being put in either a pilot training as a pilot or as a navigator or as a bombardier. Wherever their need was, if your flying training would more or less equip you to be a pilot. Your navigational training or your bombardier training would perform someplace else as far as I can remember. But I guess my size and being able to pass the test for the single-engine fighters, I was trained as a fighter pilot. graduated in 1945 as 45, Class 45C, got my commission as a second lieutenant, and went from there to, Eglinfield, Florida for gunnery training, in Godmanfield, Kentucky for other training, Walterboro, South Carolina for additional training, where they found out that we were getting ready to be shipped overseas to replace some of the pilots returning from the old 99th group. And then the war ended, they had an excess of pilots, navigators, and bombardiers.
Okay, Mr. Adams, you were saying about then you had gone to, you were about to go to the, you were going to be called up, and then the war ended?
After that, there was no great need, and we became surplus, I guess, to the service. So they made the stipulation that they wanted all of the fighter pilots to decide to stay in the service for 2 additional years, or they were going to have to make some changes either in their particular location, their commissions, or whether they wanted to be a part of it. That 2 months later, they came back and said it has to be a 3-year enlistment, or they were going to have to possibly you lose your commission, be put back as a non-commissioned officer, or be submitted to some other group, because there was no need for the additional pilot training at that particular time. So they started giving us inspection duties and officer in charge of guards and all that nonsense. We were only permitted to fly 4 hours a month in order to get our flying pay. And I got a little bored with the inactivity and decided that if there was no need for me in the service as a pilot anymore, and there was a need for me to be back home, that I would leave the service and get my discharge, which I did in 45. I was not one of those who went overseas. I was fortunate enough to graduate from flying school, and I valued that particular part of my life. But if I had been aware of the fact that I would only have 1 year guarantee of returning to my job as a form of employment, if I had known that that was all I would have been able to secure, I probably would have stayed in for the 3 years that they wanted you to stay and took my chances on being able to come out at the termination of 3 years and maybe we'll get that job back or another, or attend some school someplace where I could get some information and training as to another type of employment.
Well, you know, let's go back to the Tuskegee training. So where did you, when you started these grades of flying skills,
mm-hmm.
Where were you all flying? Were you flying over where did this flying take place?
You mean the area in which?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
Well, most of it took place over Moton Field, but we had low altitude cross countries, night cross countries, high altitude performance over Alabama, Georgia. We flew a variety of routes, traveling, let's say, between low altitude cross country. I think we may have crossed parts of Georgia. We had certain destinations you had to arrive at certain times, whether it was night or day. To perform at night was quite a thrill, too. I became lost on one of my night flights, missed my destination by some points of time. Decided that I'd do a 180-degree turn and get back on course to Tuskegee. We had, unfortunately, the upper-class captain and the class of 44, I believe, 43 or 44, abandoned his plane on a low-altitude cross-country at night.
Did he abandon it?
Well, I guess he became lost and bailed out. He lost the plane, and I guess he had to get back from wherever he parachuted to safety. But they washed him out because of that. It was a night flight, and I couldn't understand why he didn't use his instrument training, his night viewing problems that he had come in contact with. But for whatever reason, he bailed out. And I had encountered the same problem myself on a low altitude cross country at night. I guess the wind blew me off of my compass reading, but unfortunately, fortunately for me, I didn't bail out. It was a matter of doing instrument flying training that I had, made a 180 degree turn and went back to the direction which I had come, and was able to go down and buzz the towns that I passed, and each of those towns has a name printed on the top of some of the buildings. And we have to carry a chart with us and strap it to our thighs as a general rule. So when Keith became disorientated, we could go down and buzz the town, find the location of it, and head back to where, hopefully get back to Tuskegee. So that was fortunate in my case. I was class captain too at that time, had been in the upper advance. I didn't have the same fate that the classmate ahead of me had, but I got back safely to Tuskegee. Subsequently, the next night flight that I had an instructor check me out as my flying capabilities, and I made that successfully. So I didn't have that problem anymore, but it was an experience that I say that I never forgot.
I can just imagine. Well, did any of the guys who ended up flying overseas, did any of them come back to Tuskegee and see you all, or did they ever come back to the place of training?
We met some of them in Walterboro, South Carolina, which was a shipping point for returnees. Whether they went back to Tuskegee or not, or got training or accepted as instructors or not, I really don't know.
What kind of stories, after you had gotten to Moton Field, what kind of stories had you heard about the men who did go across seas and were able to fly? What kind of stories had you heard about them?
Well, their inability to be placed where they thought that they had earned the privilege and the priority of being trained and being able to fly with some of the other more experienced pilots. I heard that they were not given that privilege. I can understand that to a point, because as a person having graduated from training at Tuskegee and with little or no experience as far as flying in combat or in a theater of operation, what they were limited as to what they were would be permitted to do until they had the experience of either the bombing, the patrol training, or whatnot. I can understand why they necessarily would not have been given the opportunity at first, but after they had become qualified and they had to undergo a great deal of training in a theater of operation which was all combat tactics involved. Now, whether or not they were given that opportunity when they thought, but in the end it must not have been, because the Red Tail pilots that I read about were given the credit for not having lost any of the bombers that they escorted to their particular places or any of their other craft. So it's, I guess, the idea that inexperienced people just graduating from flying school mm-hmm. would not have the qualifications or the experience of a seasoned pilot until they got the adequate training in their theater of operation. So I don't know what factors were involved in that to substantiate what some of them, what the write-ups were saying, they were not given the opportunity. So I say again, I wasn't involved in overseas. My training in Florida over Eglin Field and shooting at moving targets on gunnery trails I had to take were experienced, but that's altogether different from flying at a tow target and flying somebody shooting bullets and bombs at you. So
right.
I really don't know what they went through. I have no adequate knowledge of saying that. There was one fellow that lived in Kansas City, not far from where I lived at home, John W. Davis, was credited with one kill, I think, and one probable. Now, I never really talked to him about his experiences because we never actually came in contact with one another. But I can understand the exemptions that they made until they were qualified. But they meant those who did fly the protecting for the bombers and their mission that they were assigned to did an excellent job. Whether it was destroying the enemy equipment or the planes or protecting the bombers that they were supposed to.
Okay, Is that another? When you were in Florida and your other training after you left Tuskegee, were you in an all black units or were you in integrated units?
Still all black.
Did you ever enter into an integrated unit of
the flying?
No. Right.
No, the only encounter I came across in realizing that there was another school of training there on a low altitude cross country, I landed at a place where the same ships, the same coloring and all, the same type of markings, and when I pulled up to company headquarters in the plane on the landing strip, there were all white cadets there, white officers. I had landed in the field where they were training whites, and they told me that my particular location that I was seeking as a destination was about 20 miles, and I forgot the direction where I was going. It was altogether ahead of, still in Alabama, but still not that particular place. That's the only time I recognized the fact that we had whites training at a different place.
Were they angry with you, or they just told you where?
No, they were surprised, I guess, to see a black man getting out on an airplane, and I was surprised to see all those white faces with the same kind of ships that we were flying from Tuskegee. But they were obviously training someplace, and there was a guy up to, who was it? Brotherhood Bank was in a training program for whites. Now, I didn't ask him where he got his training, and he didn't get overseas either, but he took a separate course from the same type of thing because of the fact that he dropped the college requirements. And he got his training in the South, but he was working in the same mail room that I was with Brotherhood Bank as a part-time job. But he didn't get overseas either.
But he was white.
Yeah, he was white. Mm-hmm. And that's the only time that I came in any contact with white cadets or students flying planes in Alabama.
When you were in the South, did you go to any of the towns off the base area? Did you go into any of the towns?
Oh, yes, but not as far as visiting the restaurants. I went to private homes.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're seeking something about race relations. I had an incident of passing about four white soldiers. Where was I coming from? Visiting my aunt, I believe, going back to the bus station. They said, "Here comes the nigger lieutenant, let's salute him." They saluted me. I saluted back and went on my way. But they called themselves, I guess, being smart or funny or whatnot, but it didn't make any difference to me.
Well, when you were in the South, I noticed you said that you things were different. You certainly recognized that.
Mm-hmm.
But did you ever go out into the larger white community in any other way in the South? Yeah. Right?
No, came in contact with white officers in different places, but
how were they? How was their treatment of you?
Well, as far as I know, the only incident I can remember that brought something questioned to my mind, I was leading a group of soldiers, going, I guess, from a mess hall to back to the barracks. But I wasn't an officer then, but I passed this. I don't know whether he was a second lieutenant or first lieutenant. I was a tech sergeant then. I passed him and I gave the command to salute the officer, you know. They presented arms. We passed him. I saluted the officers as they passed. He asked somebody in his group to stop me, and he wanted to talk to me. He wanted to address me because he thought I was being smart by addressing him with recognizing his particular status with a hand salute. He thought it was I was being smart or something. And he brought me back and had me back to standing attention before him and said, I didn't appreciate that attitude in which you presented as you came by. Is that supposed to be something that clever? I said, I was merely recognizing your status as a commissioned officer, sir. And when I get to be in your same position, I hope to get the same kind of respect.
What did he say to that?
He said, "Carry on." And that's the only time I remember being addressed by an officer who felt that was being it's a group of black soldiers mm-hmm. going by him, and recognized. I thought he'd be returned the salute. I don't know whether he did or not, but it was just something I always felt. You show that respect for his bars, mm-hmm. not necessarily his face, whatever it is. But he was either a second lieutenant or a first lieutenant. And to say I was a tech sergeant then, but that's the only time I can remember any incident with a white officer that I came in contact with.
When you were working with the Tuskegee Airmen, what was the social relationships like within that group? Who were some of the other people? Do you remember, not necessarily by name, but do you remember from what, where did they come from? Were you the only one from the Kansas area, or?
You mean of my class?
Uh-huh, right.
No, I had a classmate named Clarence B. who lived in Kansas City, Missouri. We both graduated as second lieutenants. I had a William Knight who lived in Topeka, Kansas. He graduated as a flight officer. I don't know what qualified the difference.
Did those of you from that area, did you all hang together, or?
Well, we were in the same class. See, we had 60 members started out together mm-hmm. in primary training, and 23 graduated.
Wow.
So William Knight, Clarence B., were all Kansas individuals. I kept in contact with several guys in Casey in Chicago, Powell in New York.
Clayton Powell? No.
No. His name was William Powell.
Mm-hmm.
He got a job as a probation officer when he left the service. A lot of the fellows I say I used to keep in contact with for a few years, and then they just suddenly dropped them.
Sure, sure.
But I say out of our group of 60, 23 were left.
So what, did the other guys just have to leave? Is that what they had to do?
No, some stayed in. Those who accepted the idea that they were going to either be put back or they wanted, some volunteered, I guess, to stay 3 years. We had one classmate, wasn't in our class after we left, Kenneth Wofford. He stayed in. He dropped back to get married, left the class in 44, I believe it was. I don't know whether it was sickness in his family or what, but he left and went home and came back, but he was put in a class following ours. Instead of graduating in 45C, he probably graduated in 46-something.
Mm-hmm.
But he stayed in, and he was retired a lieutenant colonel.
Wow. So he made it kind of a career, almost.
Yeah, he made it a career and stayed in Minnesota.
All right, so Well, tell me, looking back on your experience, particularly your Tuskegee training, what do you think you liked most about being in the service?
Well, the chance to get an opportunity to fly a plane that I've never thought I'd have because I couldn't afford it as a youngster. Didn't want to put the money into it and all the training as a civilian, but I always enjoyed the idea of flying. I couldn't have done that on my own. I could not have gone to Boston. I was proud of what I was able to achieve as a person who was drafted. My technical training, the flying capabilities, and the opportunity to put 4 years of college in, which I spent in an art school, to get my master's degree. So
you had gone to college after this is you went to college after
yeah.
service. Okay,
mm-hmm.
What did you experience in the military that you did not like? The least thing that you liked.
The thing that I didn't like was the idea that even as a graduate from the flying school, I was not able to put the time in acquiring the knowledge of how to work around a plane. I don't know anything about inspecting the wings, the ailerons, the flaps, or anything. If they had allowed us to go down to the flying line and mingle with the mechanics or whatnot, learn that plane, observe how it handles outside. Knowing how to handle the controls is one thing, but knowing what makes those controls work and how to inspect that plane so that you don't leave it to a crew member to do it, put us to good use in studying what can be useful to us as pilots on a plane, and not necessarily have to have flying time. We had all those days and hours we could have been put to use. I'd rather go down there for anything more than just oil this or learn how to manipulate some of the mechanics of a plane, the motor, the construction of it, the control of it, then sitting it down, making some stupid inspections, doing nothing. Mm. I just got bored.
Well, tell me, the people who were maintaining those planes you were flying at Tuskegee, were they black maintenance people or were they white?
I really don't know. What I can understand, we had black. Those were in Tuskegee that I knew were black.
Were black. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Now, whatever obligations they may have had, I don't know. But those who came out to put the gasoline in the planes to inspect them before we took them off were all black. Mm-hmm. And there were no whites around there at all. Now, I don't doubt that there was some white someplace on the line, uh-huh. whether they had a white group flying, cadets flying someplace else, I'm quite sure they were white, but they were not together. Mm-hmm. Right. But I just get bored. You're going to take me from fly 4 hours a month to save gasoline, and here you want to send some graduate over there to possibly even staying in later. If I had thought I would have had the retraining and the flying experience with another war or whatever else that could have been done, I wouldn't have mind volunteering for 3 years. Mm-hmm. Come back to a nickel and dime job that I had, and then taking care of the family was fine. But even at home, I'm finding things to do. I have radio television servicing. I've got a job. I work at the post office. I do radio television servicing. I make rubber stamps. I sell mutual funds, life insurance. You give me something to do, and you keep me busy, then I'm satisfied. I have to have an income for a family. But I don't like to be bored and seem like wasting time. And that was seeing all the years I spent in the service. This is so much that could have been done with that time. Make it enjoyable and make it useful.
In terms of your discharge, what was that like? Oh, you remember what your procedure you went through?
No, I just let them know that I'm decided to. I'm going to apply for my honorable discharge. And as far as I can remember, whether the office work that was necessary, just going in to the company commander at that particular base, let it be known what you wanted to do, apply for it, and in due time you have it. Really, really no great procedure to that. It's a lot more simple than being drafted to go into service.
When you were discharged, then what did you do?
Well, I came home and got my little job for the 1 year that I was guaranteed. But when I came back, they had the black operators were segregated from the white operators and the international stage employees and motion picture projectors. That's an entirely white organization for white only. They have seven people have gotten together, some qualified, some not qualified. That's what my dad was trying to do, to get together to form a union comparable to what the white international 170 had. Mm-hmm. When I came back, the blacks had been given an opportunity to, not only with the three theaters they had, to get two more, the Lincoln and the Gym, from the white organization. That would have given them five theaters, and they had seven required members in order to become a part of that. Well, they had Norval Parker had been instrumental in getting that organization started. They had the Lincoln and the Gym theaters, which made five. So they put the Princes on the same roll of one of those theaters and their union, which qualified them to have a charter from the international. When I came back, my guarantee for 1 year made it mandatory for them to release that job with the Princes, and I get it for 1 year. Then after that, they can get it back. But they said, as long as you're qualified and you've had the experience as a motion picture projectionist, we need you to help run out five theaters. So I got the job as a relief person working at all five theaters.
Wow.
Not back at the Princes. At the Lincoln, Gym, the Carver, the Regal, and the Princes. at the castle.
Wow.
So over a period of time, when the stereophonic sound came in, and we had the managers in some theaters weren't too proud of having blacks in that particular place, but the one place...
So some of these theaters were white theaters?
Well, they were white-owned, yes. Most of them were white-owned.
Who were they relegated to white patrons only, or were they... Or was it a mixed...
Blacks could only attend certain theaters. It was segregated unless you want to sit in the crow's nest in some place,
okay.
Just like in the
Did service. Any of these theaters that you were working with, did they have the crow's nest?
Not the blacks. The Electric and the Granada on Minnesota Avenue did.
But you didn't work there?
No. Couldn't work
so
there.
So you only worked in places where the patrons were all black?
Yeah, until the time that the International set up the segregated unions and the affiliated 170A, which was black, all the A organizations were auxiliary units, and they were black. They have to be joined together. So when that happened, we lost, because of patronage on the theaters, business fell off. Blacks could go anywhere they wanted to, so they had to close some of the theaters where blacks were attending only. They could go where they wanted to go. But we became part of that organization. I think I was the only one in that particular time, because we lost the other theater and other guys had other jobs. But I was business agent of the organization which I had worked up to, and we were mandated to be a part of the white organization. Of course, it was still segregated, and some of those operators didn't want blacks anywhere near them. So when it was mandated that they had to be together, then they had to accept us as members, but we had no tenure as far as positions were concerned. We had the bottom of the list.
Even though you had spent other time, a longer time?
Yeah.
So you had to start at the beginning?
Well, no, you didn't have your position.
You didn't have seniority.
No,
they didn't count the years that you had done.
That's right. You were on the bottom of their list as far as work was concerned. Mm-hmm. But they gave me, what did I have? I worked at some of the white theaters, Antioch, 63rd Street Drive-In, Bannister Mall, Union Station, several of those, all whites. White 170 had those, but they had to give it up to some of us. And I was the only one left who said who wanted to stay with them and be a part of the organization. So I was accepted, but I was still some that didn't want me in that group because I was black and taking their job. That's what they didn't want. But I got along swell with most of the organizations and stayed with them until I retired from the post office and the motion picture theater in 84. But up until that time, in 61 or 62, I think, when we had to drop out entirely. I was always a part of 170, mm-hmm. Previously 170A, where we had seven charter members and five.
Did you all ever have to go on strike?
I went on strike for the white organization down in the plaza. I walked the picket line there with them at the Plaza Theater. Now, I don't think they ever got anything out of it as far as... It didn't stop people from attending the place. But the 170, the mother organization, or the parent organization, didn't have any great success with that because they were putting management and operations together where they have big platters now. They don't have two machines in one booth. I worked at the Bannister Mall. There were five theaters. One operator took care of five theaters.
Oh.
They were on big platters like you have on tapes. One platter over top of the other, and they were about five rolls of film for a two-hour show could put on one big platter 4 feet in diameter, and it would run from one tape to another, just like a tape does, from one place to another, just like that cassette does. And that way, one operator could take care of five theaters, which had banished them all. That's what I had for a while. But some of the other places, the Antioch only had two machines, 63rd Street Drive-In, two machines. Kilo on Main Street with two machines. I worked in all those places.
When you left the military with an honorable discharge, you went right back, you were able to go back to your job for at least a year with the projectionist.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have other kinds of employment that you, and you, did you also vote? How did you get employed by the post office?
Well, I carried mail during the Christmas periods for several years before I went into service, and I decided that I was going to apply for a permanent job. I could work the motion picture theaters at night, work the post office in the daytime. So I took the test for it and asked for clerk first and passed the test. And when they told me you'd have to work nights as a clerk, that would interfere with my night job. So I passed that up and took the test again and asked for carrier. I passed that, so I worked post office in the daytime and theaters at night.
So what was your daily routine like? What time do you have to get up? And what was your time schedule like every day?
Well, you had to be at the work post office at 7 o'clock in the morning. You worked from 7 to 3:30. I had to be at the show at an hour ahead of starting time, 6:30, from 6:30 to midnight. Then you go home and sleep, and you get up at 6 and get to the post office at 7 and work from 7 to 3:30, 5 days a week. But I had Saturdays and Sundays off from the post office, worked to the show. Sunday from 12 o'clock until 12, and the rest of the time, when I first started, I came back from the service, I didn't get my old job back working 7 days a week, but I worked, they let me go at the Castle Theater until they got those other two theaters. The Greek's family that I worked for had another Castle Theater they owned, with three theaters, the Castle, the Regal, and the Prince's. When I left the Prince's and I came back, they gave me the job at the Castle for house manager until the local got to Lincoln in the gym. Well, with my experience, the manager at the Lincoln demanded that I work there because the others didn't have any stereophonic equipment experience. Mm-hmm. So when Norval Parker became ill, he insisted that I get his job, which I had. I took Norval Parker's job and worked as business agent all through the time that worked at the Motion Picture Theater until we were joined together. Then I say again, I worked at all of the white theaters that they had access to. So,
when you left the military, did you get married?
Yes. That was one reason for getting back home, though, for a little lady, Barbara Harris. She was graduated in 1943, I guess it was. Yeah, 1940. Got married in 1946 and had my one year at the Prince's. Then I went to the Castle for a few months, and then I worked as a relief operator and worked all five theaters that they had until Mr. Norval Parker became ill, and then I got the job at the Lincoln. And I stayed at the Lincoln until I retired. So I worked at post office.
And yeah, but those were two good paying jobs.
Oh, yes. And I did radio television servicing on the side, did my artwork on the sides. And
what artwork?
I have a master's in painting. I went to the Kansas City Art Institute and Kansas City Junior College in order to get my academic credits to get my BFA of Fine Arts, and get a BFA, and then I got my master's of Fine Arts.
Now, when did you pursue those degrees? Was it immediately after leaving the Army, or was it later?
No, a little bit later. I had a lawn service out in Leawood, and I decided that I wanted to try to do something with my Army time that I had 4 years of college. I didn't have the contact here that I needed for architectural training, and I took my DeVry Institute out of Chicago for my electronic training, so I had art that I could attend classes there and still work. So I
went to Did the military pay for that?
Yeah, 4 years. I got 4 years of Army, of schooling from my time in the Army. I spent 37 months in the service.
So they paid for that?
Oh, yes. With the exception of 6 months to get my master's, I had to pay six months of that in order to complete it. But otherwise, my Army time allowed me to have that free training.
So you didn't get married until after you left the service?
Right. Left in 45 and got married in 46.
Okay. Did you have children?
Yeah. Four sons. There were little four there, and my wife and her four sons there. Robert, David, George, and John.
So So is your wife still living?
No, I lost her in 98.
And her name was Ms. Barbara Harris, was her?
Her maiden name, yes, Ms. Barbara Harris.
Did she ever work outside the home?
Yes, she was, when the boys became of age, she was a librarian for Quindar School, worked in the educational system. She got her degree in library science.
Is that right? Where did she go to get her degree in library
she
science?
She got it through the junior college here, and her training at, what did she have? Training at Hawthorne School gave her the academic work hours she needs to graduate. To give her credit for that.
That's great. Because I went to Atlanta University, and a lot of people have gone to Atlanta to their library school. But that was a long time ago.
What was your particular field class?
My field was history, but my friends were... I went to Atlanta University for my graduate degree in...
Atlanta University?
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of a young lady down there that... Well, she got her nurse. One got a nurse training in Tuskegee, and another was attending. I forgot the name of that place, but she got her training at in Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia. But I can't remember the place that she was.
And you had four children.
Yep. Four
did your children attend school here in Kansas City?
Oh yes.
Okay.
Washington, when they dropped the segregation, I guess they split the areas that John and George went to Wyandotte for their graduation, and Robert went to Washington High. David went to Wyandotte, too. See, instead of going to Sumner, they could graduate from Wyandotte. Then those boys.
So none of your sons went to Sumner? Because Sumner didn't close until 78, right?
That's it.
Okay, your phone. So let's continue talking about your experiences after leaving the service. So you got these several jobs. Tell me, when you came back, did you live with your parents? What was that situation like?
Well, I lived with my parents at 3rd and Troop until I decided that... the young lady and I were going to try this married life together. So in September 18th of 1946, we went through the marriage ceremony, and I left my parents and moved into the old Douglas Hospital as turned into an apartment house. And I lived there and with my wife until my number one son, John the Third, was almost 5 years old. That was in 1955. We moved out to 3133 North 38th, where I live now. I have been here for some 50-odd years.
Was it a neighborhood at that time, or were there just a few homes here?
Well, Brentwood, which is north of here, was being developed, and Weaver Estates in the same area was being developed. There were whites around us, and they were moving out. And, of course, we had white neighbors on the west of us, and we had black neighbors on the south and the north of us in this particular area. But as time progressed, Weaver Estates and Brentwood area developed, and people moved into that particular area, and they developed it all as far west as 38th Street. But we lived here all those years with our neighbors until Brentwood became developed, attended Quindar School with our children. And I worked my lawn service until I got a chance to go in the post office. Between the motion picture theaters and my rubber stamp work and selling mutual funds and insurance, television and radio operation and servicing, I decided the art school was a good thing that I liked to fulfill my ambition of being a portrait artist. So I attended art school, got my academic credits required from the junior college here in Kansas, and then was able to get my BFA and MFA from the Kansas City Art Institute, and since I didn't want to teach school, I just professed it, the idea that I would do my developing paintings in oil, keep working at the post office, and I didn't have time for lawn service anymore.
Well, who were some of your subjects of your paintings?
Well, I did not pick notable individuals. I picked and painted my family, my mothers, my sons, my wives. I picked, did paintings for Roosevelt Butler, from Reverend William Dancy and Mrs. Dancy, beautiful woman. Let's see what else. Did several paintings for the church, Church of Ascension, which was at 3rd and Stewart at the time.
So you're an Episcopalian?
Well, I consider myself a Methodist now. At that time, I guess I was Episcopalian because I attended church with my mother. But when my mother passed and my wife was a Methodist and our sons were baptized and attended the Methodist school, First AME, I joined that church as a family and made that a successful event. Still a member there.
First AME.
First AME at 8th in Nebraska. So,
an active. What other sorts of activities or positions have you held in First AME?
Well, really, at First AME, I've just been a member. I tried to be active as far as finding ways for the church to earn money, doing the painting requirements that they wanted for signs painted, or I didn't do any of the painting on the walls or anything of that kind, but when they had conventions and they wanted signs painted, I took the liberty of doing that for them, working around the church. But
did you ever paint portraits of some of the people in the congregation?
No, not for them. I had several individuals that I did, as I say, Reverend Dancy and his wife, Dr. Dyer, Ben Boyd's daughter, a couple of friends out in California that I did work for.
Did they pay you for your...
Oh, yes. It's sometimes you make it as a gift. And say again, I have done a painting for a woman at Faith House in St. Louis. My son was a director there and wanted a painting done, so it gave me an opportunity to do that one. I painted portraits of Mr. and Mrs. Lawrence Jones Sr. at the funeral home in Kansas City, Missouri. But when I found out there was no great demand for paintings, when you can have a photograph taken, and people prefer a photograph in many cases more so than a painting, and you don't have the time to sit for it. So,
yeah, it's a different. Where did you do your? Did you have a studio here, or where did you do your painting?
Well, when I was at working in the motion picture theater, sometimes I'd do my artwork. Doing the shows, I worked at, when we had on Douglas Hospital, I did it in the attic of the old Douglas Hospital, and here at my home, I have activities that I can work sometimes out in the yard, sometimes in the house. It's just a matter of where you have your greatest need and you have the time to do it. But I found many times it's more profitable to sell mutual funds and insurance than it is to try to get people to pay for artwork. So, as I say again, I tell them, take a picture and enlarge it, and that way you don't have to worry about people sitting up for it. Ben Boyd wanted Dr. Gill wanted a painting. Dr. Gill and Mrs. Gill wanted a painting done of their mother. I did that. Many times it's just to try to accommodate others, and I did not want to travel around to try to make myself known in different places in order to exhibit.
That's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, it sure is. And then you... I can understand how some people earn thousands of dollars for. If I ask $400 or $500 for a painting that I put 60 or 70 hours on, I'm not going to pay that kind of money for that. And I don't blame you. Go take a picture, and then do like some people do: spread some shellac over it, and make lines on it, and you have a painting that satisfies some people. I went over to the Art Institute, not the Art Institute, Bruce Watkins' places where there's all kinds of enlarged photographs, beautiful work. People don't want to pay to have someone sit there for an artist's interpretation of some things. I did a painting for Will Florence in her political area. The person
who is that?
Will Florence Robbins. You don't know her. She was very active in the YWCA, quite active in the local chapter here.
You mean in the Yates?
Yates, uh-huh. That painting is still down. That I did is still down on, used to be down on 13th in Washington. But she had a painting done that the person, too, I thought, did a terrible job of putting in oils what I felt Mrs. Robbins looked like. I knew her from years back. My wife worked with her in the YWCA, and my wife was one time a national officer in the Y through Mrs. Robbins' contact. But this painting did a person did a terrible portrait of Mrs. Robbins, old and drawn out and cold-like. And I talked to her cousin, who had control of her property, and to allowing me to take that painting and do it over. And I did a more pleasing portrait of Mrs. Robbins, I think, and I did. And people say I flatter that which I see. Maybe I see beauty in everything. And I don't have anything wrong with that, because I mean, sometimes you take a photograph, they put iron out all the lines and things mm-hmm. that you don't want in there. I don't try to do that, but I try to see beauty in whatever I do. And with my paintings, I say I don't try to rob people as far as money is concerned. I tell them, you want to go take a picture. I take pictures of it, many poses, and put them all together as to what I feel I'm looking at. Sometimes that's good and sometimes it isn't.
When you were living at, you said you were living in the apartments of the old Douglas Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Did Douglas Hospital operate at that particular time, or do you know? When your son, you went there in the early 1950s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was there a Douglas Hospital operating at that time?
Out on 27th and, North End of 27th Street was out there then. It was
uh-huh.
fully in operation then. But this was the old building on Springfield and Quindaro.
Okay. All right. And who owned that? Mr. John Adams in his home in Kansas City, Kansas. Today is Thursday, May the 12th, 2011. My name is Deborah Dandridge, interviewing Mr. Adams. And this is the second interview. We're going to go into some more detail that we may have missed in our previous interview. So, Mr. Adams, we were talking about when you got to the Tuskegee Army Airfield. What kinds of things did you go through from there, do you remember?
Well, after the preliminary pre-flight training with one of the instructors, which was my first encounter in an airplane at all, gave me a training mission of different maneuvers, I guess, to familiarize the student with a particular phase of training where it's going through spins or dives or rolls to see if that student is able to physically endure the travel of air in the air. It didn't give me any difficulty, so we flew around for a while, making me familiar with the town and the area, and went back down after about an hour and a half of preliminary flying. From that pre-flight, we went to primary training, which constitutes an instructor in the rear cockpit and a student in the front, and the possibility of, after a series of maneuvers with your instructor, you get an opportunity to fly solo. After solo flights, you're enabled to take that plane up by yourself and hopefully bring it back successfully with no damage to it. You are able to complete that particular effort after the preliminary training with the instructor. From there, you are told to go up and practice certain maneuvers, whether they be figure eights, low altitude cross areas, stunts, stalls, spins, snap rolls, if you have read the instruction book on how to maneuver them and you can try to execute them. So it's the basis of, once you have finished soloing and have been able to complete the primary course, you advance to lower basic. Basic is the first opportunity to fly low-wing, I guess, simulated fighter ship with fixed landing gear. You have the basic maneuvers to execute in lower basic. You are exposed to short field, long field takeoffs and landings, low altitude flying. You go up on your own without the instructor. and practice of different maneuvers, whether they be simulated combat, flying with another instructor, another student. Sometimes you have formation flying in basic. You have exposure to instrument flying, flying under the hood, which enables you to fly on a fixed airplane model with simulated instruments inside it. And you have blind flying, basically adjusting your altitude, airspeed, horizontal instruments and all sort of thing to guide you without leaving the ground. That's what they call hood flying. That's to enable you to be able to fly instruments in darkness over areas in which you have no sight of the ground above the clouds. That's in lower basic. After you've completed lower basic, you advance to upper basic. Upper basic gives you an opportunity to fly with numerous other students and their instructors, simulated formation, simulated combat, flying as a group instead of just one or two, flying wingman positions. You fly with 8, 10, or 12 ships, flying formation and simulated battle. Once you complete upper basic, you have an opportunity to go to advance, where you fly the first time with an airplane that has a retractable landing gear. The BT-13 in basic had fixed landing gear, which you could not pull it up once you left the ground. In advance, lower and upper advance, you had an opportunity to fly the AT-6, which has a retractable landing gear, is a much faster ship than the BT-13, but is occupied by a student and the instructor for the first basic principles of flying. More or less is simulated combat, formation, short field takeoff and landings, night flying. Let's see, night flying across country, takeoff and landings at night, simulated battle, formation flying. And once you have completed those particular steps in advance, you have reached that stage at which you have been able to complete the course successfully and get a rating, and you'll be able to either receive your graduation notice with a second lieutenant or a flight officer. I don't know the difference between the two, but that was the epitome of flying once you have completed advanced courses. That was the ultimatum of flying. And from there, once we graduated, we went to Eglin Field, Florida for gunnery training. Went to, South Eglin Field, Florida, Godman Field, Kentucky, Walterboro, South Carolina for flying with an actual fighter that was being used overseas. In our cases, Class 45C, we use the P-47, the Thunderbolt, or called the Jug. It's a much heavier plane, retractable landing gear, used as a bomber and a fighter. That was the next step prior to the P-51s, which was more or less, I think, designated in our outfit as the Red Tail Angels, as they were called, those who had been overseas and able to fly in that particular formation, escorting the bombers to different positions. I never did get an opportunity to engage in flying the 51, but I did fly several training hours in the P-47. When I found out that they were no longer needed as far as pilots to replace those who were coming back from overseas, they put us in several details of inspections and, I guess, general services around the air base in which we were attached. But we were limited to flying only 4 hours a month in order to get our flying pay. And since I felt that they no longer wanted us and they wanted an opportunity to either encourage us to volunteer to stay in the service for 2 years, that was the first qualification for it. Then they came back about 2 months later and said 3 years was the least that they would accept you on a volunteer basis to stay in the service, or you may take an opportunity to leave the service at your will, or possibly you might be demoted and lose your particular status as a second lieutenant or as a flight officer. So I took the opportunity, since I wasn't needed there, just to vacate from the service and come home.
Well, that's excellent. Thank you for summarizing all that. Let's talk about what was it like when you first got on that airplane. Do you remember what you felt, or what kind of feelings did you have about the training itself? Do you remember? Was there some things that surprised you? Were there some things that you expected? What was it like in your feelings toward it?
Toward
the airplane flying?
Are you speaking of before we started primary?
Yes, or any time, any of the time. Before you started the primary, when you first stepped into the plane, what did you think about it?
Well, it's my first experience of being in a plane and in the air. I was more or less thrilled to be given the opportunity to see what it was like with somebody else piloting the plane. It didn't upset me at all. Sometimes I understood that the violent maneuvers in an airplane, you could become airsick. That didn't bother me whatsoever. It was just a thrilling ride like they have on some of the play areas where they have the certain rides. I don't know what they refer to them now. Roller coasters,
right,
where they
right.
have excessive speeds and they go up and down and twist around in there. That same type of action, I guess you can experience the plane. But in a plane, you're sitting on a parachute and you're strapped in. Where in roller coasters and things, I think you're exposed to a great deal of openness that you don't have in an airplane. But as I say again, it was more thrilling, more or less, to me, just to be able to witness that in someone else flying the plane who was qualified to do all the maneuvers that I expected to do in the future.
And that person who was in that plane with you during the primary, what were they, black or white?
Black. We didn't have white instructors in primary that I remember. Now, they may have some in advanced class, because the number of qualified black instructors was limited, as far as I can remember. There were some white, I believe, who took care of the advanced classes. But
was
most
there any
of the,
particular reason why there were fewer African Americans?
Well, I guess not too many of them were qualified in pilots to give that instruction to the sergeants. Some of them came from college, I believe, and they had an opportunity to, sure, they had the money and the desire to become part
money.
Of the training, yes.
Yeah, money for more. And tell me, what were the things that you found most easy about flying? What things were never a challenge for you?
Well, I can't say that every part of the plane was a challenge as far as becoming familiar with what made that airplane move, either go up, down, right, left, or whatnot, getting acquainted with the different maneuvers that you have to go through. But as far as learning, you have to spend a certain amount of cockpit time, as they experience, read the manuals, sit in the plane, become familiar with the instruments, how to observe them, how to handle the controls, what forces the plane to go up and down, use of the flaps, the ailerons, whatever instruments that you have to maneuver.
So did you ever do some of this on your own outside of the training sessions themselves? Did you ever try to familiarize yourself by yourself, do that on your own?
Nothing other than reading manuals.
Mm-hmm.
They give you a manual when you first become a part of the training session. You have to study that. You have the privilege of sitting in the plane at times if it's not being used.
Right, uh-huh.
And become familiar with the cockpit procedure, as they call it.
Did you do that on your own a lot?
Not really. During the student time in training, we had a certain amount of time to spend in school, in classes, learning the aeronautical theory, and then we had the time to go out on the line,
uh-huh.
sit in the planes, become familiar with all the instruments and things in them, put into practice what you had learned in the classroom, and put it to use there before you got a chance to fly with your instructor.
In these classrooms that you were exploring the theory, aeronautical theory, who was it? Who were in those classes? What kind of issues would you all discuss as a class? Do you remember, or do you?
Well, I say again, the theory of flying, what forces the plane to go up and down, what maneuvers are necessary to divert the control, how do you recover from spins, what you know the technical terms of stalls or spins, of figure eights, slow rolls, or snap rolls, spin recovery.
Did you ever do a figure eight?
Oh, yes. That figure eight is a very simple maneuver. It's just like tying a bow tie on a tie or your shoes. You just execute on a straight and level with a figure eight. Spins and stalls are altogether different. You put that plane nose up until it stalls out and no longer able to fly, and it's going to drop nose first towards the earth. You have to learn the procedure of recovering whether it spins to the right.
Did you do those kinds of things?
Oh, yes. Yes, that's part of the training. You have to stall it first, let it drop down, and know the recovery procedure, how to recover, how to go up, make loops, how to make snap rolls, slow rolls, all those things. You read it in the books.
It sounds exciting, but also very frightening. You never found this frightening?
No. Not once you know what you were doing.
What was it like? You remember the first time you began doing those routines? What was it like?
Well, thrilling. After all, you're flying at about 5,000 feet. You've got plenty of space to recover. Perhaps you've read the manuals. And you go through those things with an instructor. You don't do it by yourself
mm-hmm.
first.
Mm-hmm.
The instructor's in there with you. And if you have the proper procedure, you do all those things before you solo. But you have the privilege of knowing those things. That's what they teach you in the classrooms. And you put that what you have learned in the classrooms, and when you have a chance to go up and execute those maneuvers at certain levels. But that's the interesting part about it, just like driving a car. The more you drive it, the better you become familiar with it.
Right. Now, did you some flying, obviously, on your own? I remember you're talking about flying to Georgia and back.
Well, low altitude or high altitude cross countries, yes. Those were planned things by the instructors.
Mm-hmm.
You have certain points of contact that you're supposed to pass over and recognize, and you have a regular pattern you're supposed to fly. Sometimes three or four places making contact by visual contact, and you make the last contact back at the base as a rule, unless you have been instructed to land at a certain field to practice short takeoffs or short landings. But that's a part of the regular procedure that's given you, whether it's in the day flights or whether it's night flight.
During all of this training, what worried you the most? Or what worried you at all?
Well, being able to satisfactorily complete the course and get a decent rating where I can become a licensed pilot, I can say it that way. In this case, it's to get your commission saying you have completed the course, you had no problems, your grades will decide whether or not you had one status or another, I assume. I don't know that. Otherwise, whether you stay in the program to complete it is based upon whether or not you have the fortitude, the aptitude, and the physical and mental endurance to be able to control that plane.
Did some of them not make it?
Oh, yes. We started out with a class of 60 people, and in primary we had 45. 15 had either washed out for some reason or the other. And in graduation, having completed advanced class, we had 23 graduated in single engine out of 60 to begin.
So that wasn't a very great survival rate, was it?
No, not really, but they have numerous reasons, I guess, that they washed you out.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact, some of them, maybe their academic work wasn't satisfactory. Sometimes their physical endurance wasn't satisfactory. Sometimes they're flying and executing the maneuvers that you were supposed to be doing was not satisfactory. So,
did you ever meet and work with or talk with any of the white pilots during this time?
No. We never came in contact with any whites. I take that back. Coming in contact with going on a low altitude cross country, I landed at an incorrect field. I thought from the distance height that I was flying that this was the field that I was supposed to land in. But when I landed and rolled up to the flight line, all I saw was white faces around the planes and on the flight line. And went into headquarters and asked if I had made an error of landing at the wrong field. And was instructed, yes, and the field that I was supposed to go to was on course. But it's about 20 miles, I guess. I forgot what direction I was supposed to go.
So you had to get out of the plane and
oh,
meet
definitely.
These people.
Oh, yes.
So how did they treat you?
Well, just as normal as far as I can say. I guess they were surprised to see my dark face, and I was surprised to see their light faces, too. So I guess they feel this guy either stupid or he's He's off course one way or another, but I didn't recognize the fact that white and black were not trained together. Obviously, there was a place in Alabama that was catering strictly to whites or other than blacks or Asians or whatnot. The Caucasians had one place, I guess, they were training, and the blacks had another.
Did these guys treat you okay? They just helped you on your way?
Oh, yes. I had any contact other than a couple of people in the office, and they were officers and flight instructors. The people that were around the planes there, I had no contact with them at all, because the minute I found out I was in the wrong field, I immediately go back to the plane and took off and headed for the direction that I was supposed to land at the field where our training course, where headquarters was.
Mm-hmm. So they didn't bother you in any form or fashion?
Had no problem whatsoever there.
So after the military, what was your life like after the military, after you decided to go on and leave the military? What was your life like after that?
Well, I had a job as a motion picture projectionist at the Princess Theater where I...
And that's the job you had before you went in.
I went in the service. I had that opportunity to go back to that with the idea that I had at least 1 year of positive assurance that I could not be taken off that job. That mm-hmm. was my guarantee from the service. But I didn't realize the fact that many things had occurred there. They had a union had formed, and the operators were all unionized, even though there was a separate organization from the parent organization. And I was not able to hold on to that job after the year's time, because the management of the theaters had the obligation of giving me that for 1 year, and they were kind enough to give me a job at another theater in Kansas City, Missouri, the Castle Theater, to make up for whatever time I may have lost before this operators' union, which was all people of color. They had a need for seasoned operators because they were going to get two other theaters that they did not have access to prior to that. That's the Lincoln and the Jim Theaters. That after about 7 or 8 months of working at the Castle Theater as a house manager, they accepted my application to become a part of the union, 170A, and I went to work as a relief operator at the five theaters they have one night a week at each theater.
So when you came back home trying to work at the Princess, mm-hmm. all the operators had all of the it was a union shop in the Princess, had it become a union, everybody was union and you weren't, is that right?
Right.
Is there any reason you couldn't join the union then, or?
No, they had no need for it. They only had three theaters, and they had seven operators.
Okay, and so they had reached their fill on that.
When they got the other two theaters, the Lincoln and the Jim, well, they needed someone to fill in, and uh-huh. they needed someone who could work for them, because they were already handled by 170A, which was a white organization, and the managers of those theaters were insisting upon that they have qualified operators. So I went to work with one night at each of the theaters, for the five theaters they had.
Union by then? You were union
yes.
by then.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like getting into the union?
Not a problem. I was qualified. I had 5 years.
What steps did you have? Did someone ask you to be? Did you go into it? How did that happen?
No, I applied for it because I wanted the job that I had. I'd worked the Princess for 1 year as a qualified operator,
uh-huh.
so my experience was well known as far as they were concerned. But they had no need for other men to come in and take the place of those that were qualified already. With only 7 men and 3 theaters, they had enough as far as employees in order to take care of their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
With the additional 2 theaters, they needed someone else in order that they could depend upon to put to work immediately, which, as I say, my experience put me in a position to accept that. I applied for it with initiation fee and whatever else was required. That's all I had to do, and I went to work right away.
Did you ever work in the union itself, you know, doing union meetings? Did you ever participate in that sort of thing?
In due time, I became not only the treasurer, I think was my first promotion. After the treasury job, I took on the job of a business agent.
What was the name of this union?
Local 170A. It was an international alliance of stage employees and motion picture operators, 170A. and A indicated that they were not a Caucasian group. 170 was strictly all white. That was a part of their particular requirements, I'd say, and it was white local, no blacks, no Asians, and anyone else involved. But the mandate came down from Washington that the parent organization must take in the A locals. There should be no separation between auxiliary locals and parent organizations. So when that happened, we became part of the 170. We dropped the A, but they only took in, let's say, we didn't have too many theaters at that time because our tenure was low. But I think three of us at least started working with the so-called 170. I was one of those three. Whereas the other fellows had other jobs, they didn't particularly care about being a part of it. So, in the long,
were you one of the few African Americans in that union then, once it dropped its
yes.
color line?
Mm-hmm.
So you were treasurer and...
Well, I was treasurer and business agent of my local, and that local one, and we were joined together. I was just another member.
Did you ever move up in the ranks of the union when they merged?
No.
Did you try?
No.
Why not?
Well, first of all, the parent organization was, I guess, being interested enough for those who wanted to participate to allow them to join. I had an opportunity to be accepted in that local and go with them on some of their meetings with some of the managers of different theaters, since I was the only one there. But I wasn't going to try to jump the gun and trying to say, because I was a minority, that I had to have a prestigious job over some of the others because of my tenure. Anybody who came behind me was still did not have the tenure that I would have had. But some of those fellows had been in there for 30 or 40 years.
So seniority played Trump the race car. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they had been in there longer than you.
Mm-hmm.
How did they treat you? How did they, when you all merged, how were you treated by the other union members, white union members?
I have no complaint whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I know there was some that didn't like my being in there, but there was some that
How do you know they didn't like that?
They expressed themselves.
What did they say?
Not necessarily saying, it was the idea of that why would he be given some of the theaters that were their privilege to join, to have at that particular time. And they made that something that they felt that the 170 should give them preference. They wanted an explanation as to why any person. I joined the picket lines and everything else that they were a part of.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't feel that I was, I paid union dues, so I had the same privilege that the rest of them had, depending upon what number of years that I had become a part of that.
Right, right, yeah. Right.
So I had no problem.
But they resisted you?
Some did, yes.
Did they intimidate you physically? Or
no.
They just were not nice people. Mm-hmm. Were you raising a family then?
Yes.
So you had married and had children by that time?
Oh, yes. I married in 46, and I had that first child in 51. And by 56, we had three in the family, all three boys. But I had no great amount of difficulty racially, I'll put it that way. I grant you that segregation, as far as people of color were concerned, took away many of the so-called opportunities for our theaters to stay open, businesses to stay open.
Right.
Particularly the theaters, when the general public could go to other theaters and be accepted, not necessarily have to sit upstairs or sit in certain areas. Mm-hmm. They had much better opportunities, and then the newer movies and presentations were at some of the other theaters who had the more prestige and the more money.
Mm-hmm.
But the black theaters, of those who were attended mainly by black, were not able to get the main productions as soon as the other theaters, so blacks went where they could go.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an acceptable thing, something to be expected. Whether or not it was in the restaurants, clubs, or whatnot, the segregation, in some ways, was beneficial. In some ways, it was hurting in some jobs and locations and that sort of thing.
So when they when the black theaters finally went down here, what did you do?
Well, I had another job too. In fact, I had two jobs.
Okay, tell us about it.
Well, I worked in the post office, went in as a, applied for a job as a clerk because I thought I'd want to work inside. Mm-hmm. But when they told me that if you passed the examination for clerk, you'd have to work nights. And I didn't want to lose my job as a projectionist because I wanted to have both of them. So I passed that job up, took the exam again, and asked for carrier, where I could be working outside and I wouldn't interfere with my night work. Mm-hmm. So I worked, when I went on as a sub, I worked a limited number of hours. When it became regular, I guess it was in about 2 years, I worked a regular route in the daytime, worked theaters at night, and I had a lawn service out in the plaza in between, and went to art school.
Wait a minute, let's talk about this lawn service. Was this your own private business?
Yes.
So how did you get started into that?
Well, I worked for the Greek family who had the theaters, and in doing work in their homes out in the plaza and on Leawood, numerous people would stop by and ask, after I guess I became acquainted with the neighborhood, ask if I had any time that I could give them. And worked up to where I could work 6 days a week if I wanted to in private family, from one person to another and from friends asking if I had time that I would be able to give them. So I had a thriving business for 6 days.
So you were working three jobs for about how many years?
Well, let's see.
Just an estimate.
I'd say almost 8 or 10 years on three jobs. On two jobs from 1957 until 84, I worked two jobs, post office and in the theaters. I did the lawn service in between. When I attended art school, I had to drop the lawn service because I couldn't. I had to go to art school to try to get my degree in illustration and painting.
And what was the motivation for doing that, for entering art school?
Well, all of my young life, I'd say, I had been able to draw, and I always found a great interest in drawing and painting, and just thought I'd take an opportunity to put it to use, thinking I could make some headway as a portrait artist.
What was that art school? What were the classes like? Did you enjoy them?
Well, yeah. The art school was more or less biased, too, in some ways. I went to the Kansas City Art Institute, and they had a limited number of black students there. And from what I understood, that they had certain rules that you blacks and whites sometimes did not have the privilege of doing, associating, not in the classrooms, but around the campus and off campus, I guess, in that particular area. But that's was to be expected, I guess, in most schools of that kind. But I had no great amount of difficulty in that school as far as race was concerned. It was just how you treated people, how you handled yourself.
Okay, Mr. Adams, you were talking about your experience with the Art Institute
mm-hmm.
as a student.
Well, I said I did very well as far as the associating with the men and young men and the young women in that classroom. I had no difficulty with the teachers. I had all good high scores and honor record as far as the school was concerned, and I had opportunity to gain a commission to do a painting for a funeral home on 47th and Paseo. I've forgotten the name of it now. They had a contest on doing presentations for. To be awarded a prize from the school. I participated in not only that and was granted the award for that particular company. I had some of my work accepted by some of the so-called artists from out of town to come through there and ask to send them a particular copy of some of the lithos that I did in lithograph class. Several models from whom I gave personal drawings because they felt that it was something they wanted to keep. I think I was not only blessed but just very lucky to be able to do something that I had enjoyed doing basically all my life.
What years did you attend the Art Institute? I mean, was it in the 50s or 60s? Do you remember?
You know, I think it was in the late 50s and early 60s, 60s. I think it was. Yes, late 50s and early 60s. I got my BFA and 1 year and left there to go to junior college to get my academic credits, and came back the next year and spent another year to get my master's. So I was able to get 2 degrees from the Kansas City Art Institute.
So, after that, so let's say, what were you doing? What did you, went on and sort of did some self-portraits, I remember you talking
around
about.
Around locally, yes.
Right, and who are some of the people that you did your paintings? You remember some of the people?
Roosevelt Butler, Dr. William Dyer. I did a painting for the crucifixion for St. Episcopal Church down at 3rd and Stewart. I did a painting of Mrs. Wilfrance Robbins for the YWCA. I did several paintings for people in the movie business. Mr. What was his name? Louis Coppulas. I did a picture. I take pictures of the particular individuals to save them the time of posing, and then I have a composite painting that I do in order to satisfy what that person may want for their family. I've done a painting of a doctor. Gill, a doctor and Mrs. Gill, who live out on Georgia, did a painting for, Reverend William Dancy, did a painting of his wife for Reverend Dancy. I did a painting for Benjamin, he's an insurance agent, I'm trying to think
that's
of his
all right.
name.
You might remember his name.
I've done several locally, but...
So you did your artwork outside in another building outside the house? Where did you do your artwork? Where did you do these?
Sometimes at the theater at night, sometimes at home, sometimes...
So you didn't have a studio or anything?
Oh, no. My studio was either my family room or out in the yard. When I was in Douglas Hospital as an apartment, I did it in the attic, wherever I could work, wherever I had the time.
When were you in Douglas Hospital?
The time when I was first married, me and the wife and I moved to Douglas Hospital after our marriage in 1946. Stayed there until 1955.
Was it operating as a hospital then?
No, it was an apartment house. Mrs. Emerzer Pendleton took it over and operated it as an apartment. There were 8 families living there.
But by that time they had moved to Western, is that it?
No, they were out on 27th Street, at the end of 27th Street.
Oh, the hospital itself?
Mm-hmm.
So the hospital was still operating, and it had just moved from those headquarters?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever go to Douglas Hospital as a patient?
As a patient?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Where did you go for hospital care?
When I went to the hospital and was bitten by a dog, I went to Bethany down on 12th and Central. Was bitten by a dog and had to go there for...
Was that while you were carrying mail?
Yeah. where else did I go? That's the only place that I have been. No, I went to... Did I go to Providence St. Margaret's for... I was trying to think what I had then.
Well, before you went into the military, where did you go to the hospital?
Didn't go.
You never went to a hospital? What about your folks or anybody or your friends? Where did they go to the hospital?
University of Kansas.
Okay. They didn't go to Provident. They didn't go to Douglas.
No. They went to physicians, I guess. Dr. Alexander treated at, I think he treated at Bethany. He was at hospital. He had hospital privileges at Douglas, too, but I think my mother and father went to University of Kansas. Yes, I know that. My mother and father went to University of Kansas for their difficulties. Whether it was contact with Dr. Dyer, whom my mother worked for, or whether it was just the acceptance of that particular place, because Douglas Hospital, once they left Springfield and Quindaro,
mm-hmm.
they became known as a place where they did a lot of abortions. And I don't think too many people wanted to frequent that place that didn't require service.
But that wasn't during the 40s. That was later, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was much later. By that time, that must have been around the late 50s and into the 60s. Then. Is that correct? Or do you? It's hard to put a time on that.
Well, having left there at 55, it must have been, I carried mail in 57. It had to be 60s.
Yeah, the 60s, 60. That it had become that. Mm-hmm. So, what was it, do you remember anybody going to Douglas House before that time, when it was on Western University's old campus? Do you remember anybody going to Douglas then, when they had moved there?
Well, I carried mail out there. They were on my route. But now I don't necessarily know the people who attended that place. But they had a good patronage as far as I was concerned. And they had, whether it was abortions or whatnot, they were still very well, I'd say, frequented as far as people coming there for service.
Mm-hmm. In terms of, who was your family physician?
Dr. William H. Dyer was my physician my mother worked for, and he attended my parents most of the time. Dr. Alexander was another.
And he was African American.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And did you know any nurses in the community or anything?
No. I knew Dr. William Love. I knew Dr. What's his name? The guy that did, I had a small tumor removed from my left testicle.
That's
Becker.
Oh, Dr. Becker.
Dr. Becker. He performs.
Because he's a urologist, mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Who else did I know? Most of the doctors that I had any contact with at all, let's say whether it was dog bites or anything of that kind, were black.
Uh-huh.
As far as attending whites, I didn't have that necessarily need. If you need for a specialist, if I were referred to that, like Dr. Norman Foster, I went to him for a cyst I had on my left wrist, and I was referred to a doctor, from Dr. Forrester to Dr. What the heck is his name? The surgeon out on, and from that individual, as much as I know his name, I can't think of it now.
That's okay.
The only surgeon I know of around here, and he has a very attractive wife that's very friendly and knowledgeable. How I got to Watson.
Oh, Dr. Watson.
Dr. Watson. From Dr. Watson, I went to Dr. Perry, William Perry, and from Dr. Perry, I went to Dr. David Emmett. That's the first white physician I went to. But he was, because he was a specialist in the particular field, and that's, I wasn't getting too much satisfaction from some of us, shall I say, Dr. Forrester for one, and Dr. Perry, I didn't particularly care for his tactics, so when my son, who was in St. Louis, made the mention of his contacts with different physicians in St. Louis and physicians here, that they got me an appointment with Dr. David Emmett. He was supposed to be one of the top neurologist, oncologist in his particular field, so that's how I came in contact with them.
So what kind of, I think you may have mentioned this to me, but what jobs did you, careers or employment did your children go into?
Well, let's see, my number one son, John the Third, is in St. Louis. He went into business administration, got his master's from, let's see, Fulton, Missouri. Yeah, he got his master's there. Number two son, George, went to KU in a field of music. After his second year, he decided he wasn't getting the musical training he wanted, so he dropped out of there, went into TWA and working as an employee there. Number three son is went to KU for 2 years and decided that he wasn't getting the side of training he wanted to get there, so he dropped out and went into businesses and working in an ice cream business. He has his own little business now. Number four son is didn't go to college. He finished high school and decided he wanted to be a musician and went to Brady for years. And now he is, he works with me on taking the blind, helping take the blind person, plays for a certain church, Greater Jerusalem Church on
Tech Street. What does he play?
Drums and keyboards.
Wow.
What else? He also works with a Mrs. Tony Oliver, and went part of the teaching staff that she has, and works several night spots, I guess, in Kansas City, Missouri, and in local places out in the city, whether it's Horton, Kansas, or Hiawatha, Atchison. He has been overseas to Holland.
Travel due to music?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Tell us something about your wife.
Oh, my wife was a very talented woman. I think that she would not only have beauty, but she had skilled in administrative qualifications. She was a part of the one of the first blacks to be a part of the national headquarters out of the white WCA through the efforts of Mrs. Will Florence Robbins. She participated in that for years before she decided that she was going to have children. And prior to that, let's see, she went to Horsfield down in Kansas City, Missouri for a job.
Mm-hmm.
She worked there for a while, and she was noticed by the employees of Cricket West out in the plaza. And she was asked if she would take a job there as working as one of the buyers.
Hmm.
And she left Horsfield and went to Cricket West.
Did they have any other African-American women doing that buying then?
No, I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. Yeah. But they must have had a few out there.
No wonder I loved Cricket West. They had good choices. Go on.
Well, whoever the person was that there came down to Horsfield numerous times, and
mm-hmm.
my wife worked with a Jewish lady. She was using her as a stock girl. And she said, from what seemingly talent and appearance she had and her personality, they were going to put her in charge of one of these departments at Horsfield's. But they had an offer from this person from Cricket West who was trying to develop the store there and offered her a job there. So she had an opportunity to be one of the first blacks to be hired in that area.
How long did she stay with that?
Until after, see, our son was, let's see, Butch was born in 51 and moved out to where we are now in 55. I think she stayed with Cricket West about 3 or 4 years.
And so that was in the 40s?
Yeah. Late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
When I came out from the service, yeah.
Wow, wow. So what did she do? Did she... About
I say, until our son became of age where they could be dependent to come home and be by themselves, my wife stayed at home. When that passed, she worked at as a Cub Scout leader, and she worked in the church, and she worked at Quindaro School in the parent teachers group, and was head of the parent teachers organization for years. And she finally had a job offer at the as a librarian.
You were talking about Mrs. Adams.
She had a job at Quindaro School as an assistant in the library department.
Uh-huh.
And some contacts that she had from the Board of Education and her Parent Teacher Meetings Association, she was asked if she would be interested in participating and becoming a qualified librarian. She'd have to go to junior college or someplace in order to get her academic credits. And she accepted that, attended the junior college out here on 72nd, attended night classes, and she became a qualified library assistant,
mm-hmm.
working with Val Forsythe, who was a librarian. She was a Caucasian who was in charge there. She got my wife the job as her assistant, and Barb stayed that until the time that she retired from the Board of Education I've forgotten what year that was, though, but she was in her 70s when she quit there. But she liked that work. She liked working with children. At Quindaro, she was, the first black as far as the head of the parent teachers in that area, in that school. So she did a marvelous job between the Cub Scouts and her school work and being a career mother and a and a librarian and a community leader, church worker at First AME. I don't know how she handled all those things, but she's a very talented, gifted woman. Very patient, as I say. In the time that I was trying to pursue my career as to working two or three jobs, that she did the same thing with her activities in the YWCA and in Quindaro School and the national organization. She made trips back and forth to different places where she was participating in her official capacity. And as Hawthorne librarian for years, she retired from there. So she was busy as a woman and a mother and all those other things as a housewife. I say again, she's an extraordinary, hard-working individual. Very proud of her.
What did she do after retirement?
Well, between the church, First AME, mm-hmm. and as far as the school was concerned, she kept her activities going in different places, and then between the library, calling her for different bits of information, she spent most of her time at home, and I say being whatever she could be serviceable here. But they called on her for numerous things, acting in different organizations. She's presenting, making club dedications. Different clubs asked her to come in and give their officers presentations and that sort of thing, where she was knowledgeable about Robert's rules and club organizations and that sort of thing. She's a busy woman, I tell you. She had, unfortunately, contracted diabetes. And that sort of limited her ability to get around. So, and that eventually helped to take her life. But other than that, she was a very busy, dedicated woman, a mother, and a wife.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your time, and thank you so much, Brad. Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.